more like how you'd shush a yappy dog. If I wanted your opinion, I'd... For real, bro, Ephraim had said, don't go out there. Kent blinked, his head cocked at an inquisitive angle. Ephraim was the only boy who worried him. There was something a bit crazy about Eve, this jittery powder keg quality that made Kent uneasy. Give me one reason why not, man. Ephraim just said, because. That's it? That's the reason? Because? Yep, Ephraim had said. Thanks, Eve, said Newt. Ephraim said, shut up, pork chop. Next, Scoutmaster Tim had entered the bunk room and told them that their asses better remain in bed. Soon after came the commotion, the stranger's scream, Rah! Followed by a scuffle, a crash, and the acrid smell of smoke wafting into their room, mingling with the sweetly rotten stench. Kent had leapt out of bed, attacking the door with savage shoulder butts. It wouldn't budge, but Kent kept flinging his body at it the way he always did, hurling his unthinking bulk at any obstacle with the ironclad surety it'd eventually buckle. He'd only quit when the scoutmaster threatened to tell his father. Kent stepped away from the door, breathing like a bull, his wide-set and faintly bovine eyes reflecting dull, smokeless hate. Around 4 in the morning, Newton had sat bolt upright in bed. He'd been awakened by the noise of cupboard doors opening and slamming shut. Next had come crunching sounds, monotonous, plodding, softly grinding. Max, he'd whispered. Max, you awake? Go to bed, Newt, Max had said from the bunk below, his voice so thick with sleep that his words ran together. Go to bed, Newt. Newton had been shocked that Max and the others were able to sleep with those smells and awful noises beyond the door. Maybe Max was just pretending to sleep to avoid talking about them. Maybe he'd thought sunlight was a cure-all. Hours later, sunlight filtered through the sap-yellowed window, sparkling the dust motes that hung in the stagnant air. The boys rose and dressed silently, pulling on bulky sweaters and lacing their boots. Ephraim caught Max's eye, raised a quizzical eyebrow, and mouthed the words, You okay? Max shrugged, smiled wanly, finished double-knotting his boots. Like the others, he caught a whiff of the rank sweetness drifting from the main room where the scoutmaster slept. He'd heard the crunching sounds, too. Max's grandfather was a farmer. The past few summers, he'd paid Max and Ephraim $17 a day to dump chicken bones into Jaws, a stainless steel industrial grinder in the barn. He'd purchased the bones from a poultry processing plant in Summerside, $1 a sack. Legally, it was called animal byproduct, same as cow flops, hog shit, and hen feathers. Max and Ephraim would slit the woven fiber sacks and dump the clattering bones into Jaws's hopper. It was gross, mildly disturbing work, island work, wearying and melancholic, and there was an expectation that all boys should enjoy it. At least they got to do it together. Max and Eve were best friends. They'd been so for years informally, but a few months ago they'd cemented it. They'd both notched a shallow cut in their thumbs with Ephraim's Swiss Army knife, pressed them together, and solemnly intoned, Forever friends. They were one better than BFs. They were FFs. Once the bones were in the hopper, Max's grandfather would switch the machine on. The gears made quick work of them. When the collection receptacle popped open, inside was a drift of fine white powder. Bone meal, Max's grandpa said. It's magic, boys. Nothing grows plants any better than bones. Hearing this, Max wondered why farmers didn't plant potato fields over cemeteries. The answer had dawned on him before long. Last night, lying quietly in bed, Max wondered if Ephraim was awake too. Was he hearing those crunching noises? If so, was he thinking what Max was thinking? That it sounded like tiny brittle bones pulverized between the steel teeth of Jaws? After dressing, the boys followed Kent into the kitchen. Tim greeted them in the main room with a wan smile. The strange man lay on the Chesterfield, his body covered in blankets. All they could see were the contours of his face, the sunken cheeks and eyes, teeth winking through the blanched fillets of his lips. Crumbs lay scattered round the easy chair. Newton spotted those same crumbs on Tim's lumberjack vest, though the Scoutmaster brushed most of them off. An Econo-sized box of soda crackers lay in the trash can, along with some wadded-up cellophane cracker sleeves. Tim caught Newton's look. Attack of the Midnight Munchies, boys. I had to keep an eye on this guy. Newt scanned the kitchen. He couldn't help but notice the busted radio, a pinworm of dread threaded into his chest. What if that storm rolled in? What would we do? He eyed the cabin warily. The frame seemed sturdy enough, but the roof was old. He'd seen what those late autumn storms could do. A few years ago, one of them had ripped across the mainland and dragged a car across the street into a ditch. Newt had watched it happen through the window of Dan's luncheonette on Phillips Street. The car was an ancient Dodge Dart, what the old-timers called 2 tons of Detroit rolling iron. The driver was equally ancient. Elgin Tate, a long-retired music teacher. Newt had watched him white-knuckled and greasy-faced behind the wheel as the wind hammered the car amidships, rocking it up on 2 side wheels and letting it fall with an axle-grinding thump, then gusted again and bore it steadily across both lanes into the ditch. The Dart's tires had been pure smoking as Tate tried to muscle it back onto the road, but its hind end tipped over the edge of the ditch, its front wheels canted up and spinning uselessly. Once the storm had passed, Tate clambered out the window and staggered onto the road. His gray hair was stuck up in wild corkscrews, and he was smiling like a man who'd cheated death. "Hellfire!" he'd shouted at nobody at all. "Hellfire and damnation!" "What are we going to do?" Newt asked. "That's what I'm trying to figure out." Tim hooked his thumb at the stranger. "He's obviously sick. He also, as you can see, smashed our radio. Why, I don't know. Could be he's in trouble, maybe with the law. I certainly don't know who he is." "What about his wallet?" Ephraim said. "I checked." Tim's hands groomed each other, an unconscious gesture, one hand washing the other. "His pockets are empty." "He looks empty," Shelley said softly. The boy's eyes kept flicking to the man, then just as quickly away. Newt threw his entire head back as if the very sight repelled his gaze. "He probably didn't look like that all his life," said Kent. "Of course not," Tim snapped, annoyed at Kent's unalloyed disgust. "As a precaution, I've tied his arms and legs. Who knows what else he might decide to bust up." "Yeah, good idea," Shelley said. "I mean, he could go berserk, kill us all with a butcher knife." Tim glanced at the tall, slender boy with the blank gray eyes. His brow furrowed, then he said, "I have something to ask all of you. I want you to be honest. I promise you I won't be angry. Tell me, did any of you bring a phone?" Newt said, "You told us not to." "I know what I said, Newton, but I happen to know that teenage boys don't always do as they're told." He looked at Ephraim. "What about it?" Ephraim shook his head. "I thought about it, but..." "Shit!" Tim hissed, pushing the word through his teeth on a burst of pent-up air. He tasted a weird sweetness, a saccharine tang on his tongue. "Listen, boys, we're going to be fine. Really, this is unexpected is all. My only concern is that this guy needs medical attention in short order. I don't have the proper equipment."
"You said he came by boat,"
said Kent. Tim had already been down to the dock at sunup. The boat wouldn't start. The spark plugs were gone. Could this man have unscrewed them and... what? Thrown them into the ocean? Hidden them somewhere? Why do that?
"There's a boat, yes," Tim said for now. "Oliver McCanty's, by the look of it. You know how small it is. We can't all ride back in it."
"A few of us could," said Kent. "We could tell my dad what happened."
Kent's father was Lower Montague's chief of police. Big Jeff Jenks, a towering 6 feet 7 inches and 250 pounds of prime law enforcement beef. Most afternoons he could be spotted behind the wheel of his police cruiser, looking, Tim thought, like an orangutan stuffed into a kitchen cupboard, circuiting the town. If anything, his face reflected sadness, perhaps at the fact God had given him a body so big and strong that he considered it a cosmic injustice that he couldn't put it to use on deserving criminals. But he'd picked the wrong jurisdiction,
The closest thing to a felonious mastermind in Montague County was Slick Rogers, the local moonshiner whose hillside stills occasionally exploded, burning down an acre of scrubland. You guys are going on your wilderness trek as scheduled. You were going to be trekking solo anyway as part of your merit requirement, so just fend for yourselves and navigate your way back. No help from me. That's crazy, Tim. Kent stabbed one thick finger at the stranger. We need to neutralize the threat, one of his father's pet phrases. Or else... Kent trailed off, the words locking up in his throat. Tim dropped the hand on Kent's shoulder. The boy's eyes narrowed. In that instant, Tim was certain he'd brush his hand off. When that didn't happen, he said, "What we need is to remain calm and proceed with the established plan." "But it's all different now. The plan is... it's fucked." A shocked gasp from Newton. Nobody ought to speak that way in front of an adult, in front of their scoutmaster. Tim's eyes took on a hard sheen. His hand tensed on Kent's shoulder, fingernails dimpling the fabric, close to, but not quite, a claw. "Scout Law Number 7, Kent. Repeat it." Kent wormed in Tim's grip. His eyes held a bruised hangdog cast. "A scout?" Tim said softly. "Go on, tell me, a scout?" Newt said, "A scout obeys his..." "Quiet, Newt," said Tim. "Kent knows this." "A scout obeys," Kent said, each word wrenched painfully from his mouth. "Who does he obey?" "He obeys his scoutmaster without..." "Without what, Kent?" "Without question. Even if he gets an order he does not like, he must do as soldiers and policemen do. He must carry it out all the same because it's his duty." "And after he has done it," Tim continued, "he can come and state any reasons against it, but he must carry out the order at once. That is discipline." Tim forfeited his grip. Kent stepped back, rubbing his shoulder. Tim pointed to a pair of walkie-talkies on the table. "You get into a jam, radio me. We've done plenty of orienteering together, right? This won't be anything new. It's a nice morning, no foul weather in today's forecast." No other boy spoke against the scoutmaster's plan. Nobody wanted to be here in this cabin with that. They were all too happy to invoke that particular license of boyhood, the one that stated, "Let the grown-ups handle it." Events that seemed overwhelming and terrifying to their boyish brains were dispelled like so much smoke when the adults took over. Adults were fixers. They were solvers. The boys still trusted Tim, even Kent. So they would depart into the crisp autumn sunshine, their lungs filling with clean air. They would wrestle and run and laugh and enjoy their freedom from this strange responsibility, whatever it entailed. And when they returned, everything would be fine. They sincerely believed this because, up until that very point in their existence, it was a fact that had always held true. It truly had been Tim's intention to go with them, but he needed time to figure out what the hell was the matter with this man. The fact the spark plugs were missing was an additional worry, and not only because it cut them off from the mainland. What kind of man would incapacitate his only method of escape? A criminal? A hunted man, perhaps? Or a man on an extinction vector? Once the boys had left, he'd go down to the ocean, roll up his pants, and search for those damn plugs. Anyway, the boys were resourceful. The island was safe. There were more hazards on the mainland. Pellet guns, dirt bikes, Slick Rogers. They'd hike a few hours, complete their trail craft requirements, and be back in time for supper, by which time he'd have this mess sorted out. He, too, believed in the power of adults. Tim didn't quite feel up to a hike today, anyway. He shot a quick look at the man on the Chesterfield, hoping the boys didn't catch the quiver in his eyes. The spot where the man coughed on his skin burnt with an edgeless heat. He pictured it eating right through his skin, a gaping hole in his cheek, the glistening connective tissues of his jaw, iron fillings winking in his molars, and shook his head, dispelling the image. Could be he was coming down with something. A fever? Starve a cold, feed a fever, right? Yes, definitely a fever. He picked up one of the walkie-talkies. After a short deliberation, he gave it to Max, ignoring Kent's miffed look. He gave the boys a curt salute. You've got your marching orders, dog faces. From Troop 52, Legacy of the Modified Hydadid, as published in GQ magazine by Chris Packer. The Hungry Man, Patient Zero, Typhoid Tom. Before he was known by these names, he was known by the one his mother christened him with, Thomas Henry Paget. Tom was born in St. Catharines, Ontario, 1,100 miles from Falstaff Island, where he would die 35 years later. Birth records from St. Catharines General show that Tommy was a healthy 9.5 pounds at birth. He was a chubby baby, says his mother, Claire Paget. Chubby kid, chubby teenager. I'd take him shopping in the Husky Boys section at the Hudson's Bay. She sits in her kitchen, leafing through a photo album. Her boy lies frozen in time under the laminated pages, sitting in the tub as an infant, his mom working baby shampoo into his hair. Halloween as a toddler, dressed as a giant pumpkin. Tom had an open smile and unruly red hair. In one photo, he is captured building a sandcastle at the beach, his stomach hanging over the band of his swim trunks. He was a good eater, Claire Paget says. As a kid, anyway. Then he got older and the shame set in. He didn't like being big. Kids, right? They find the easiest soft spot and pick at it. Claire Paget looks nothing like her son. It strikes this observer that she may subsist entirely on Players' Light cigarettes. She chain-smokes them ruthlessly, lighting each fresh soldier off the ember of the dead one. But hers is a flinty, chapped elbow leanness, a body built for a mean utility. Tough kid, she says of her son. Some boys thought that because he was fat, Tom must be a marshmallow, but he could defend himself. After Tom busted a few boys' noses, the wisecracks about his weight stopped. As cutting as those schoolboy taunts had been, her son has been treated far more cruelly in death. Consider his media-given nicknames, the Edible Man, Mr. Stringbean. Consider his legacy as the man who could have kick-started a toppling domino contagion worse than the Black Plague. Consider the fact that Dr. David Hatcher, head of the Center for Contagious Disease, memorably labeled him a runaway biological weapon. Tom Paget has been badmouthed by scientists and politicos worldwide for what? For being a pawn? For aligning himself with Dr. Clive Edgerton, who earned his nickname Joseph Mengele 2.0? For being the kind of scratch-assed petty criminal who might actually accept Edgerton's offer? No. Tom Paget is hated in death because he ran. Because he failed to truly grasp the magnitude of what he was hosting and bolted. But mainly Tom is hated for the perception that he may have somehow thought he could prevail over the monster lurking inside of him. Tom Paget is hated for his ignorance of the fact that he was dead on his feet well before he reached Falstaff Island. His body just hadn't gotten the memo yet. I guess some people must find it funny that Tom was a fat kid. Claire Paget smiles, but there's not a drop of humor in it. Yeah, I guess a certain type of person would find that deliciously ironic, considering how things came out in the wash. Chapter 8. Maximilian Kirkwood and Ephraim Elliott had been friends since they were 2 years old, although Max wondered if that was precisely true. They'd been around each other since they were two, anyway. Max's mom would drop him off at Mrs. Elliott's house every morning. She always paid her babysitting fee in cash, as the island's underground economy dictated. Mrs. Elliott said Max and Eve were the very best of friends, sharing their blocks, drinking out of the same sippy cup. But Max didn't remember that, same as he didn't remember being born or cutting his first tooth. When his memories kicked in, though, click, like a light switch, Ephraim was right there. You'd never find a stranger pair. Ephraim was a creature of pure momentum, pure chaos. 140 pounds of fast-twitch muscle fiber packed into a long, quivering frame. The air closest to Ephraim's arms and shoulders seemed to shimmer, same way a hummingbird's wings exist in a blur of motion. Max was stouter, not fat, solid, and possessed a preternatural state of calm unusual for his age. It wasn't hard to picture him in the lotus position on North Point Beach, eyes serenely shut, totally zenning out. It shouldn't have worked. The differences in the boy's personality should have repulsed one from the other, like trying to touch magnets of matching polarities. But the opposite held true. On summer nights, Max and Ephraim would hike to the bluffs behind Max's house, through the long, dry grass frosted white with the salt spray off the sea. They'd pitch a tent on the highest peak, the lights of Max's home only a pinprick in the dark. Lying on their backs under the endless vault of sky, so much wider than in a city, where buildings hemmed in that same sky, light pollution whiting out the stars. They knew some of the constellations. Scoutmaster Tim had taught them, though only Newton bothered to earn a merit badge in astronomy. They could recognize the stars in their simplest alignments, the Big Dipper, Ursa Major, and Minor. "It doesn't really look like a bear," Max said one night. "Why should it?" Ephraim said, sounding angry. "That's humans trying to, like, organize the stars to our liking. You think the big guy, the grand creator, Buddha, or the flying spaghetti monster, or whoever said, 'Oh, I guess I better make these flaming balls of gas look exactly like a bear or a fucking spoon so those stupid goons on Rock 5079 don't get confused?'" He lip-farted. "Pfft, oh yeah, right," stringing the words all together. They talked about the stuff best friends ought to, stupid stuff. Their favorite candy, Max, Swedish fish, especially the rare purple ones, Eve, Cracker Jack, which Max claimed wasn't exactly a candy, but Eve said was sweet enough. Who had bigger boobs, Sarah Matheson or Trini Dunlop? Both agreed Trini's were technically bigger, although Ephraim held the opinion, sadly untested, that Sarah's were softer. Whether God existed, both believed in a higher power, though Eve thought churches treated their parishioners like ATMs. And who'd win in a fight, a zombie or a shark? "A zombie," Eve said. "Of course. It's already dead, right? It's not going to be scared of... Hey, what kind of shark? A sandy? A white tip? I could win against a sandy." Max shook his head. "Great white. Biggest badass in the ocean." Eve said. "Killer whales got it all over great whites. But anyway, I still say zombie. If it gets one bite in, it wins. The shark's a zombie." "Who says sharks turn into zombies?" "Everything turns into a zombie, Maximilian." "Whatever, I say shark. You know how thick shark skin is? I was down at the dock when a trawler came in with a dead mako. Ernie Pug tried to cut it open on the dock. His fillet knife broke. Like trying to hack through a tire, man. Who says zombies' rotted old teeth won't break, too? And anyway, what if the shark bites the zombie's head off? A zombie can't swim too well, its rotten-ass arms flopping around."
Eve considered this.
"Well, if it bites the zombie's head off and swallows it, its head'll be in the shark's belly, and it'll still be alive, like zombie alive, which is really dead, but whatever. So the zombie can bite the shark's guts out from the inside." Ephraim pumped his fist in victory. "Zombie wins! Zombie wins!"
"Ah, go to hell," Max said, conceding.
"I've been to hell," Ephraim said, his voice pitched at a Clint Eastwood growl. "I ain't afraid to go back."
Sometimes their conversation meandered quite accidentally into topics of greater importance. One night, both boys were in that gauzy-minded state preceding sleep when Ephraim said,
"I ever tell you that my pops busted my arm? I was like 1 year old, man. Can't even remember. Guess I was screaming in my crib and he comes in all pissed, lifts me up and my arm gets stuck between the crib bars and he kept pulling and my arm just went kerflooey."
He rolled over and hiked up his sleeve, showing Max the pale scar below his elbow hinge.
"Bone came out right there. Anyway, he went to jail 3 months later. My arm was still in a cast, but here's the weirdest thing, Max. 2 years ago, I went to visit him up in Sleepy Hollow Prison. My mom came with. We were sitting in the visitor's room, the chairs and tables bolted down, TV in a big mesh cage. Dad's not saying much, he never does, right? But he looks at my arm and sees the scar and asks how I got it. Like, he thought I did it to myself."
A stiff, barking laugh.
"So Mom goes, 'You did it, Fred. You broke his arm as a baby.' And my dad just gives her this shocked look. I'm telling you, Max, I swear to God, he didn't remember. Like, there's this empty slot in his head where that memory should be. Maybe he even remembers my arm in a cast, but he doesn't quite remember how it happened, right? For all I know, his memory's full of holes like that, just Swiss cheesed with them, which is why he's in jail. He He can't remember any of the shitty stuff he does. His mind erases it, so he just goes and does it all over again.
In such ways are friendships built. In tiny moments, in secrets shared. The boys truly believed they would be best friends forever. In fact, as the boat had ferried them to Falstaff Island, Max had looked at the back of Ephraim's head and thought exactly that. Forever friends, man. Until the very end of time.
The sky was scudded over with clouds by the time the boys shouldered their packs and made their way to the trailhead. They walked in the same order as always, Kent heading up the pack. Recently, Kent had even tried to break trail ahead of the scoutmaster. Then Ephraim, Shelley, and Newt. Max pulled up the rear in his traditional sheep-herding role. Once they'd passed beyond sight of the cabin, Kent waved Max up.
"You better give me the walkie-talkie," he said, dead serious.
It wasn't worth fighting over. Kent might turn it into a fight. But Kent wouldn't throw punches, wasn't his style. He'd put Max in a headlock and wrestle him down and simply take the walkie-talkie away. Or worse, make Max give it to him voluntarily, his head still smarting from the headlock. Kent was old enough, 14 years and a few months, to have lost the prominent tummy of childhood. You could see now that he might make a good linebacker as far as width and bulkiness of shoulders went. The boys followed him for the simple reason that he was the biggest and strongest and harbored every expectation that he should be followed. It wasn't that he had the best ideas. Those were often traceable to Newt. It wasn't that he was particularly charismatic like Ephraim. It was that the boys were at an age where physical strength was the surest marker of leadership. Kent had learned what little he knew of leadership from his father, who'd counseled, "It's all how you present yourself, son. Draw yourself up to your full height. Stick your chest out. If you look like you've got all the answers, people will naturally assume that you do." Kent's dad, big Jeff Jenks, often bundled his son into the police cruiser and drove a circuit of town, a ride-along, he called it. Kent loved these, his father sitting erect and flinty-eyed in the driver's seat, sunlight flashing off his badge, the dashboard computer chittering with information of a highly sensitive nature, which his father was all too willing to share. "Got a call for officer assistance there a few weeks back," he'd say, pointing to a well-tended Cape Cod belonging to Kent's math teacher, Mr. Conkright. "Domestic disturbance, trouble in paradise, the missus was stepping out. You know what I mean by that?" When Kent shook his head, his father said, "Breaking her marital vows, enjoying the warm embrace of another fellow, huh? You get me? And that other fellow happened to be George Turley, your gym teacher." Kent pictured it. Gloria Conkright, an enormously plump woman with bottled platinum hair and heaving, pendulous breasts that stirred confused longing in Kent's chest, squashing her body on top of Mr. Turley, who always wore shiny short shorts, two sizes too small. Nuthuggers, as his father called them. His oily chest tufting in the V of his shirt collars, he pictured Mr. Turley blowing on the pee whistle that was constantly strung around his neck, the air forced out in gleeful woofs as Gloria's body smacked down onto his. "There's no fate worse than being a cuckold," his father said. "You can't let some woman go stomping on your balls. You may just acquire a taste for it." Those ride-alongs, his father enumerating the secrets and shames of their town, made Kent realize something. Adults were fucked. Totally, utterly fucked. They did all the things they told kids not to do, cheated and stole and lied, nursed grudges and failed to turn the other cheek, fought like weasels, and worst of all, they tried to worm out of their sins. They passed the buck, refused to take responsibility. It was always someone else's fault. "Blame the man on the grassy knoll," as his father said, although Kent didn't really know what that meant. Kent's respect had trickled away by degrees. Why should he respect adults? Because they were older? Why, if that age hadn't come with wisdom? Kent came to see that adults required the same stern hand that his peers did. He was their equal, their better, in many ways. Physically, this was already so. He was a full head taller than many of his teachers, and though he'd never tested this theory, he believed himself to be stronger, too. Morally, it was certainly so. Like his father said, "Son, we are the sheepdogs. Our job is to circle the flock, nipping at their heels and keeping them in line. nip at their heels until they're bloody if needed, or even tear their hamstrings if they won't obey. At first the sheep will hate us. After all, we hem them in, stop them from pursuing their basest nature. But in time, they'll come to respect us, and soon enough, they won't be able to imagine their lives without us. Suffused with the sense of righteousness his father had instilled, Kent held his hand out to Max.
Give me the walkie-talkie, man. You know that's the way it should be.
When Max handed it over, Kent clapped him on the back.
Attaboy, Max. He swept his arm forward. Tally-ho!
Stung, Max loafed back to his customary position. Newton tugged on his sleeve. You didn't have to give it to him, you know.
I don't care. I don't need it.
Yeah, but Scoutmaster Tim gave it to you.
Oh, shut up, Newt.
Max regretted speaking so harshly, but there was something so exasperating about Newt, his hidebound determination to stick to the rules, like this thing with the walkie-talkie. Who gave a shit? It didn't matter if Scoutmaster Tim had given it to Max. They were away from the adults now. Different rules applied. Boys' rules, which clearly stated the big and strong take from the small and weak, period. It was just something about Newt that made Max want to snap at him, a soft, obliging quality. A whiff of piteousness wafted right out of Newt's pores. It was like catnip to the average boy. Max felt a deeper, more inherent need to treat Newt shabbily this morning. It had something to do with the strange man on the Chesterfield and the tight unease that had collected in Max's chest when he'd gazed at him. Something about the unnatural angularity of his face, as if his features had been etched with cruel mathematical precision using a ruler and compass. Max's mind inflated the details, nursing the image into a freakish horror show. Now the man's face was actually melting, skin running like warm wax down a candle's stem to soak into the Chesterfield, disclosing the bleached bone of his skull. Max's brain probed the tiny details, fussing with them the way his tongue might flick at a canker sore, the smashed radio. Why had the man wrecked it? The crumpled box of soda crackers in the trash. Had the Scoutmaster eaten them? And the itchy smile plastered to the Scoutmaster's face as if fishhooks were teasing his mouth into a grin. Max pushed these thoughts away. Scoutmaster Tim had made the right call by sending them off. It was easier out here. The dry rustle of leaves tenaciously clinging to the trees, the slap of waves on the rock face. He glanced at Newt, his wide ass hogging the trail, each cheek flexing inside tight dungarees. He reminded Max of a Weeble, those old kiddie toys. Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. Newt never did fall down. He withstood the boy's torments with stoic determination, which made it easier. Newt could take it, right? Picking on Newt uncoiled the tension in Max's chest. It was awfully selfish, yet awfully true.
Chapter 9.
What would you rather, Ephraim said, eat a steaming cow flop or let a hobo fart in your face?
It was one of their favorite games, a great way to pass the time on long hikes. Had Scoutmaster Tim been leading, the game would have been far more vanilla. What would you rather, get bit by a rabid dog or swallow a wasp in your Coke can? But now, no adults around, it took on a saltier tone.
What kind of hobo? Max asked.
It was common to mull these choices from several angles in order to make an informed selection.
How many types of hobos are there? Said Ephraim. Your run-of-the-mill smelly old hobo, I guess, the ones who hang out at the train yard.
How big of a cow flop are we talking about?
Kent called back.
Standard size, Ephraim said.
The boys nodded as if that was all he'd needed to say. He'd perfectly set the size of this hypothetical cow flop in their minds.
Is this hobo diseased or anything? Max asked, like his ass rotting out.
His morals are diseased, Ephraim said, after a pause to think, but he's been given a clean bill of health.
I'd eat the cow flop, said Newton.
What a fucking surprise, Ephraim said.
Eventually, they all agreed that, of both scenarios, scarfing a cow flop was marginally better than a strange, smelly man's hairy ass cheeks ripping a wet grunter in their faces.
It singed your eyebrows off, Kent said to appreciative laughter. It put a center part right down your hair.
What would you rather? Newton said. Give a speech in front of the whole school, or get your bathing suit sucked down the filter at the public pool?
Ephraim groaned. Aw, for fuck's sake, Newton, that's so lame.
Yeah, but, Newton mumbled, you'd be naked, right? Your bum hanging out.
Your bum? Ephraim scoffed. Your bum, really? Your pink little tushy?
Ephraim pulled a cigarette out of his pack, along with a brass Zippo. He fixed the smoke between his lips and lit it with an elaborate flourish, drawing the Zippo up his thigh, popping off the lid, then swiftly running it down again, sparking the flywheel on his trousers. He touched the flame to the tobacco, inhaled, and said, "Nothing like a smoke when you're stuck out in nature."
Ephraim was the only boy in their grade who smoked, a recent affectation. He bought them in singles, 4 or 5 cigarettes at a time, from a high schooler named Ernie Smegg, whose doughy, carbuncled face looked like a basket of complimentary dinner rolls.
"You smoke the wrong way," Kent said. "You're holding it all wrong."
"What?" Ephraim said. He pinched the cigarette between his thumb and pointer finger, the way you'd hold a pipe. "What's the matter?"
"My dad says only Frenchmen smoke like that," said Kent, "and fags."
Ephraim's jaw went stiff.
"Shut your big fucking mouth, Kay."
"You shouldn't smoke," Newton said fussily. "My mom says it turns your lungs black as charcoal briquettes."
Ephraim's chin jutted. "Yeah? Your mother's so dumb she stares at an orange juice carton all day because it says concentrate."
"Hey," Kent barked, bristling. "Don't rag on his mom, man."
Ephraim snorted, but eventually said,
"Sorry, Newt.
So what would you rather, jerk off a donkey or finger bang Kathy Rhinebeck?"
Kathy Rhinebeck was a sweet girl who'd been branded the class slut due to the rumor, unsubstantiated by anyone aside from Dougie Fez, that she'd masturbated Dougie Fez to climax in the back row of the North Point Cinema.
"Christ on a bike, she didn't know what the hell she was doing," Fez told a gaggle of pop-eyed boys in the schoolyard, his tone one of withering scorn. "What, was she yanking weeds out of a garden?"
"What's a finger bang?" Newton asked predictably.
"I'd jerk off the donkey," Shelley suddenly said. "Who wants sloppy seconds?"
This, the boy silently acknowledged, was precisely the sort of response you could expect from Shelley Longpre. He had this way of sucking the air out of a game, out of any game, really. They hiked in silence around the eastern hub of the island. The trail deteriorated until it was nothing but a strip of loose shale edged by chickweed and stinging thistles. It led around a rocky outcropping, facing out over the gunmetal sea.
"This the way?" Newton asked.
"Where else?" Kent said challengingly. "Tim didn't send us on a granny walk." They worked their way up. The shale sat upon a base of solid granite, holding the same pink hue of the outcropping. Loose stones kept pibbling away under their boots. The path, which had seemed quite solid at the outset, soon became a series of treacherous, collapsing footfalls. And then it narrowed at the midpoint of their ascent. They could barely crowd both their feet together on it. Below them lay a steep slope, carpeted with the same soft shale. It was not so sheer that they risked free-falling, but steep enough that they would slide painfully down, boots pumping and hands clawing for purchase. If they couldn't stop in time, they'd hit the cold gray sea.
Ephraim said, "Whose smart idea was this again?"
When nobody answered, they lacked the energy or inclination, focused entirely on their task, which had abruptly turned very grim. His gaze zeroed in on Kent, clumsily edging his bulk around the rock face.
"You big dumb fuck," Ephraim thought. "You stupid shit, you."
The boys turned their faces into the outcrop, edging along the rock face with hesitant stutter steps. Newton cried out, his nose scraping on a pitted extrusion of granite, peeling off a layer of skin. Straggly weeds grew off the bare rock, the tips of their withered leaves frosted with sea salt. How could anything survive in such a place, tilted crazily over the water? The boys' fingertips hummed over the rock like bugs, searching desperately for handholds.
"Grab here," Ephraim told Shelley, pulling the boy's hand to the right spot. "That seam there, feel it? There." Next, Ephraim pivoted his hips and kicked one leg out, making an X with his body, one hand gripping the rock while the other was outflung in space, one leg safely moored, the other kicked out over the waves, crashing 100 feet below.
"Top of the world, Ma!
Stop it!" Newton shrieked, sagging jelly-kneed against the rock face.
"Come on, Eve," said Max, his fingers hooked like talons into the stone.
Ephraim's eyes narrowed, a look indicative of future devilry, but he only swung himself back against the cliff.
"Keep your skin on, Newt. Don't give yourself a heart attack."
Ephraim became aware of the sound of his breathing as it whistled madly against the stone. The waves crashed rhythmically into the cliffs below, the water sucking back out to sea with a foamy gurgle. His arms trembled. The long tendons running down the backs of his calves jumped.
"We could die."
This thought cleaved Ephraim's mind like a guillotine blade.
"One of us could start to fall, and someone will try to help. Scout Law number 2, a scout is ever loyal to his fellows. He must stick to them through thick and thin, then another and another until everyone gets pulled down like a string of paper dolls."
From his vantage at the head of the pack, Kent now realized this couldn't be the right route. But whose fault was that? Tim's, for sending them out alone. Dull, metallic anger throbbed at Kent's temples. It was stupid Tim's fault that Kent's mind was now paralyzed by fear. Stupid, stupid, stupid. The trail widened on the other side of a tricky ledgeway. Kent held out his hand to help Ephraim across, then Shelley, then Newt and Max. They walked silently along a shallow upswell, sweating and breathing heavily. The trail emptied onto a flat, rocky expanse overlooking the ocean. Ephraim set both hands into Kent's chest and pushed. The bigger boy staggered back.
"Great idea, Brainiac."
I didn't do it on purpose," Kent said, his neck bright red.
"Nobody better give you the keys to an airplane, man."
Ephraim's chin was angled up, nearly butting into Kent's.
"With your sense of direction, you'd fly everybody into the sun."
Ephraim's hands curled into fists. Kent knew Ephraim wasn't shy about throwing them. Eve had been in fights. Kent, not so much. Sure, he'd shoved other boys down and put them in headlocks, but he'd never squared off with another boy and thrown real punches. He'd never had to. Being bigger had acted as both threat and deterrent. But here stood Ephraim, a creature of coiled muscle and quick rage, challenging him. Kent's hair was plastered to his forehead with clammy sweat. His blood beat a hi-hat tempo inside his skull. He pictured Ephraim's fist clocking him on the chin, saw himself falling with one leg twisted painfully beneath him. The image caused bitter saliva to squirt into his mouth. Ephraim gave him a dismissive shove.
"A fucking granny walk, eh? Bozo."
Kent hated the sudden shameful fear that rose in his throat, choking him. Hated himself for feeling it. The sheepdog had behaved weakly. He himself had become a sheep.
"Bah!" His father's mocking voice kicked up inside his skull. "Bah, bah, Kenty sheep, do you have any wool? Yes, sir, 3 bags full."
Kent bit down on his tongue. His father's voice switched off like a radio as his mouth filled with the tin-foily taste of blood. They stood on a stony promontory. The salt-heavy wind riffled and snapped at the boys' clothing. At their backs lay the darkness of the forest. Kent screwed his eyes against the shivering water. Perhaps a mile away, the white surf crested on the rusted bones of a sunken freighter. The sky met the sea at the horizon. Kent found it impossible to separate one from the other, sea and sky welded together without a joint. Sudden thunder arose. A helicopter breasted the latticework of the trees, black and muscular looking, not a traffic or sightseeing helicopter. The boys' faces broke into delighted grins. They waved. The chopper climbed into the sky and rotated around with its nose tilted down, then dropped abruptly. The pulse of its blades burred painfully inside the boys' skulls. Kent could smell the frictionless grease the mechanics used to lubricate its rotors, a little like cherry certs. The helicopter lifted up with predatory grace, swung around, and fled into the open sea. Squinting, Kent could just make out a series of squat, dark shapes strung across its flight path.
"Ships out there," Newton said. "Looks like they've anchored.
The military does maneuvers out here sometimes, but I mean, that's an awful lot of ships.
Maybe they're whaling ships, said Kent.
You better watch out, Newt. They're coming to harpoon your fat ass.
As the boy's riotous laughter washed over him, Newt's eyes returned to the water. Kent felt better, the equilibrium reestablished, and he was in control again. Newt was always good for that. But still, a bitter, alkaline taste slimed his tongue as if he were sucking on an old battery. Evidence log, case 518C, piece T09, personal effects. Counseling diary of Ephraim Elliott, recovered from Site T, 5 Elm Street, North Point, Prince Edward Island, by Officer Brian Skelly, badge 908.
Okay, so Dr. Harley, here it is. One page, like you asked. Who knew a psychologist would give me homework? So you wanted me to tell a story. Just a story of why sometimes, out of nowhere, I get real angry. Like really, really angry and get in fights. Why I want to punch my fist in a wall or in some stupid jerk's face. At first I got angry at you for asking why I was angry.
Funny.
But then I think, okay, you're just doing your job. Sorry for my spelling and all that. So here goes. First, I know I get angry. Mom says it's my dad in my blood. My dad's a real bad guy, okay? She's scared I'm going to be like him, which makes me angry. Shocker. Anyway, I try to stop the anger. Like when I get real pissed, I'll do something to push it out of me. Catwalk my bike off the seawall or climb up the school's roof. And okay, those things are risky. I could break my full neck, my mom says. But the anger goes away. Maybe the fear pushes it away? I don't know why. I'm not a scientist. Max calls me a daredevil, but that's not it. To me, it's like a person taking a pill because he's got a headache, or that pink stuff because his tummy hurts. Medicine, right? But that's just what I do when I get angry. You asked why I get that way. Remember the circus game? Maybe 2 years ago? Everyone at school was stoked. It never comes. So we all buy tickets and go, and it's the saddest thing. The animals were all sick and skin and bones and stuff. Their hair was falling out in big chunks. The elephants were droopy, trunks in the dirt. Newton Thornton even started to cry. Can you believe? What a wuss. Remember how one of the animals got away? A tiger broke out of the cage and escaped into the fields. Everyone freaked. Kent's dad was driving with a gun hanging out the police car window. The cat was gone like 3 days. People started to figure it drowned in the sea or like that. But then one night, I'm pulling the trash can into the backyard and it's there. The tiger in my yard. It was so beautiful. Fatter and more hair, like it was eating good things. Meat. Its eyes were shiny like marbles. Cat eyes, that kind. It was hiding in the bush near the shed, but it can't hide. It's a tiger. Looking at me, too. I smelled its breath, like raw liver, like Mom left in the sink on liver night. Also, I hate liver. Maybe it'll kill me? I'm thinking this. Rip me up, but I'm happy to see it. It's wild and very special. More special than the birds or deers or kai dogs around here. It doesn't belong here. It's a special kind of wild. And, okay, Doc, this is where it gets weird, but you asked. I feel like that tiger must have felt. Like lost. Like I don't really fit this place. The earth. Maybe just North Point. And I love my mom and my friends, Max, mostly. But I feel like the tiger some days. Not all days, but some. And that's when I get mad. The tiger looks at me in my eyes and soul, and then it yawns like it's sleepy and jumps over the fence like you step over a curb. I hoped it would live, be happy, have tiger babies. How? No tigers on the island. I hoped for that. But Kent's dad shot it and it died. Fucking Kent's dad. I cried. I think that was okay too. Right?
Chapter 10.
Jesus! Jesus Christ! What is that?
These 6 words cracked over the walkie-talkie clipped to Kent's belt at 4 o'clock that afternoon.
Tim? Kent said. Tim, what's wrong? Do you copy?
The boys stood in a loose circle, waiting.
It's nothing, guys, came the reply. Just sat on this goddamn thing accidentally. Kent glared, his eyes squeezing to slits. What's the matter, Tim? Come in, Tim.
Tim's voice, ragged, frustrated. Why do you have the walkie-talkie, Kent? I gave it to Max.
Anyway, how's it going? Fulfilling your merit obligations?
Ephraim snatched the walkie-talkie.
Kent almost walked us off a cliff.
Kent made a grab for the walkie-talkie. Ephraim stashed it behind his back, his chin assuming that challenging jut again. Silence from Tim's end. Then,
I hope you're joking. Where are you now?
Newton gave Tim the compass coordinates. Tim said,
you're a bit off track, but it'll be fine. Follow the path from here on out, okay?
The sun hung low in the western sky. Its reflective rays turned the poplars and oaks into pillars of flame. The boys had rounded down from the cliffs around the northern hub of the island. Newton used his compass to keep them on track.
None of this would have happened if Tim had come, Kent sulked. It's his job, isn't it?
Oh, bullshit, Ephraim vented a harsh, barking laugh.
You wanted to play king shit, Kent. Well, you played it. Now wear your crown of turds.
The muscles humped up Kent's shoulders, a defensive kick-dog posture. They walked in silence until Shelley said,
Kent's right. The Scoutmaster should have come.
Kent gave Shelley a look of pathetic gratitude. Next, he was storming to the head of the line, which Ephraim was heading, elbowing the smaller boy aside to assume the lead. Shelley smiled fleetingly, nothing but a slight upturn of his lips, not that anybody noticed. Shelley had this way of hiding in a permanent pocket of shadow, that spot at the edge of your vision where your eyes never quite focused. The boys came upon a large rock pile covered with spongy moss and decided to play King of the Mountain. It was a game they played often, but today it achieved a particular intensity, less a game and more of a fight. They played hard to dispel the jitteriness that had invaded their bones, a feeling whose root could be found back at the cabin. If they shoved and sweated and wrestled, it might just break the fear amassing inside them, same way a good thunderstorm could break the intolerable heat of a summer afternoon. Kent took command of the hill and repulsed their half-hearted attempts with hard shoves. He shoulder-blocked Max's anemic challenge and flexed his biceps, his budding linebacker's body set in a defensive stance. Dying sunlight pedaled through the tree branches, glinting off his dental braces.
Bring it on, Eve. I double-dog dare you.
Ephraim stood at the base of the hill, arms crossed over his chest, hands cupping his elbows. A thin boy. So skinny he could slip down the drain hole, as his mom said. But his limbs were roped with powerful, fast-twitch muscles, elbows and kneecaps hard as carbon. He thought about the mantra of his counselor, Dr. Harley. Don't be a slave to your anger, Ephraim. It was so hard. It bubbled inside him like that stupid geyser at Yellowstone Park, Old Faithful, except the geyser was like faithful. At least you could time it. Ephraim's anger rose out of nowhere, this giddy charge zitzing through his bones and electrifying the marrow. His rage was a dark cloud passing over the sun where, just moments before, the sky had been clear blue.
You chicken? Kent flapped his arms. Chicken, chicken, bark, bark!
Lips skinning from his teeth, a feral growl rising in his throat, Ephraim sprinted up the pile to tangle with Kent. He saw it in Kent's eyes, this desperate, crawling fear. Fear of losing partially, but also fear of how Ephraim might take it. And Ephraim saw how easily it could happen. His fist coming up over Kent's clumsy arms, his fist hammering Kent in the mush, flattening his thick, drool-flecked lips against the barbed braces, cutting the flesh open as the big boy toppled like a sack of laundry, Ephraim following him down, fists pumping like pistons to destroy the crude symmetry of Kent Jenks' fucko face. Ephraim saw all this in the elastic instant they were perched atop the pile. A silly prize, really, a mossy heap of rocks. And the possibility of violence, his easy capacity for it, drained the strength from his limbs. Kent took advantage, flinging the smaller boy down. He copped a bodybuilding pose, the flexed double crab face set in a caricature of a despotic monarch.
I am invincible!
Ephraim frowned and rubbed his elbow, the skin torn, blood weeping sluggishly to his wrist.
Not cool, Big K.
Ephraim found Newt scraping moss off a log. Newt was always wandering off to press stupid leaves into his stupid notebook, cataloging everything with a black Sharpie. Eastern sumac, Indian tobacco. God, so dorky. Ephraim wound up to give Newt a kick in the ass, feeling sort of guilty. Dr. Harley wouldn't approve, nor would his mother, so he delivered a lighter kick than usual.
Where's the first aid kit, numbnuts?
Newt rubbed the seat of his pants.
I got ears, Eve. Don't have to kick me.
I figured your ears were in your ass, Newt. Looks like everything else is. I was just knocking the wax out of them. Aren't you going to thank me?
Sighing, Newt dug the kit out of his knapsack.
Sit down, Eve. This was Newt's role, the nurturer, the motherer. He had a natural affinity for it, and the boys sporadically accepted his ministrations, accepted them, then returned to making Newt the object of their torments. And Newt allowed it, because it had always been so. He tore open a peroxide swab packet, pressed it to the wound on Ephraim's elbow. Ephraim hissed between clenched teeth.
It's just fizzy, Newt said. Shouldn't hurt.
Ephraim slapped Newt's hand away. I'll do it. Newton's eyes drifted to the sky. His nostrils dilated.
What are you doing?
I think that storm's coming, Newt said. You can smell it, like an alkaline smell, like when you rip open a bag of water softener salt.
We don't have a water softener, Richie Rich.
Ephraim bared his teeth in a mock snarl. We like our water hard.
You can spot it in the water, too. See?
Newt pointed to the sea. The water always turns red before a storm. Not quite blood red, but close. The electricity in the air as the storm brews, right? It causes plankton protozoans to lift up off the seabed. These tiny little creatures, like the tiniest living things on Earth, inflate with oxygen and turn deep red, covering the whole sea and making it red, too.
Ephraim slapped a butterfly bandage on his elbow.
Holy shit, dude, your brain's too big. Why doesn't it ooze out of your ears?
His eyes went wide.
Actually, fuck me, I see it oozing out right now.
Ephraim licked his finger and went to screw it into Newt's ear, a classic wet willy. His fingers stopped just short, though. A runner of saliva clung to a whorl of his fingerprint. It seemed a heartless thing to do, considering.
He wiped the spit on his pants, bounded to his feet, and raced off to join the other boys.
Saved your life, Newt. You owe me one.
The trail descended to a pebbled shoreline lapped by the ocean. The boys doffed their boots and rolled up their pants, wading in the icy October sea. Their ankles turned pig-billy pink. They hunted for the smoothest stones and had a skipping contest, which Kent won with 10 skips by his count.
Hey, guys, Ephraim said. Check this out.
He directed them to a deep cut within the shore rocks, fringed with sea moss. The boys gathered round. Flashes of shining skin made oily in the guttering light, unknown shapes humping over one another.
Silky, sibilant S's. Us.
It's a snake ball, Newton said.
How many snakes?
Impossible to tell. Their bodies were entwined, a writhing network of tubes like an elastic band ball. Their bodies were dark, sea serpents, and wet, like living, livid oil. That peculiar reptile smell met their noses, wet and fetid like a dewy field spread with dead crickets.
What are they doing? Said Ephraim.
They're... Newt's face went pink.
You know.
Fucking? Ephraim made a gagging noise.
That's how snakes fuck, all twisted up in a ball? Like a snake orgy?
Kent and Max laughed. Ephraim was so perverted. A snake orgy. Inevitably, someone tried to push Newton into the snake ball, make him touch it, Shelley in this case. Newt squirmed free of Shelley's long simian arms out of his smooth, rubbery grip, almost like tentacles without the suction cups, and screamed at him to stop.
Quit it, Shell! Lay off!
The other boys watched idly. There was something off-putting, sickening, really, about the scene. A bit like watching a blind boa constrictor pursue a plump mouse around a cage. The chase might go on a while, but the snake was dogged, plus it was a natural predator. Sooner or later, it'd eat the fat little fucker.
Stop it, Shell, Kent said in a bored tone.
You're gonna make him piss his pants again.
Shelley quit abruptly, turned, and wandered toward the shore. Newton smoothed his untucked shirt over his pendulant belly, turned to Kent, all stiff-spined, and said,
Thanks, Kent, but I only did it the one time, and I was 6 years old, and we were on that bus trip to Moncton that went on forever, and, okay, I drank too much McDonald's orange drink, but...
Shut up, Tinkle Dink, Kent said. Don't get too excited or you'll piss your pants, remember? While the boys horsed around, Shelley waded into a shallow tidal pool.